Preparing for Irma today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. Irma is now a Category 5 hurricane. In Cuba, they're trying to get ready.
Boarding up your home isn't easy if you can't find nails, hammers. You can't find decent 2x4s. You can't go to a Home Depot. Let's face it, there is no such thing in those terms here.
And they're prepping in Haiti, too.
Haitians are incredibly resilient and resourceful. They work together very well in times like this without a lot of support from the government or NGOs.
Plus, coming to terms with Trump's decision to end DACA.
Me personally, I'm going to keep fighting, get the word out, and let other people know that they do have rights and educate them to come out of the shadows. I already did my time in the shadows and I'm not going back.
That's all ahead today on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're tuned to The World. In the past 24 hours, a lot of words have been used to describe Hurricane Irma. Dangerous, deadly, historic, and they're all accurate. Several Caribbean islands, including Puerto Rico, are already dealing with Irma's powerful impact. And frankly, if you're in the storm's path or potential path, you should take the warning seriously. As Florida's governor tweeted this morning, remember, we can rebuild your home, not your life. The authorities in Florida have started issuing evacuation orders, with the storm likely hitting the state early this weekend. In Cuba, they're also preparing for Irma's arrival.
These are the final few hours, perhaps before I think the winds start picking up and the storm front starts heading fast this way.
That's the BBC's Will Grant in Havana.
People are bracing themselves, becoming acutely aware that now is the time that they need to buy plenty of fresh drinking water, have that to one side, perhaps start boarding up their homes. I haven't seen a great deal of evidence of that going on in Havana itself, but I'm sure on the eastern tip of the island, they're already thinking in those terms, maybe sandbags as well.
Mm. What kind of leadership is the government providing and telling people, this is what you've got to do?
People across the Caribbean are pretty used to dealing with powerful storms. But Cuba has a good track record in terms of hurricane preparedness. In fact, even during times of the worst, most hostile bilateral relations with the US, they continue to work in that area quite well, actually. And I think partly it works here, but it's because people follow the instructions that the government give out. They sort of obey the evacuation orders. They go to the shelters if they're told to do so. There are, of course, consequences if they don't obey government orders.
I know Cubans have dealt with deprivation of commodities for a long time, but is stocking up on goods from the grocery store, whatever you can find, is it a thing that Cubans do before a big storm?
It is, particularly in terms of water. Of course, canned goods are very, very important. As you say, though, the U.S. economic embargo on Cuba makes life difficult in those terms, and particularly in terms of construction materials. Boarding up your home isn't easy if you can't find nails, hammers. You can't find decent 2x4s. You can't go to a Home Depot. Let's face it, there is no such thing in those terms here. It isn't easy for Cubans.
This is the first major hurricane post-Fidel. How much has that played a role in preparations? I mean, he always projected this, I'm the leader, I've got it under control, and we're going to get everybody to safety.
Sure. And, you know, this is the end, really, of the Castro era. And people are aware of that influence no longer being there in the coming weeks and months. Raul Castro is due to step down as president as early as February next year. So maybe rather than looking at this as the first one since Fidel Castro, perhaps it's the last one of Raul Castro. We wait and see what the rest of the hurricane season brings.
Over the years, would you say Cuban authorities have a well-earned reputation for efficiency in preparing for a hurricane? Or is it just projecting efficiency that we see outside of Cuba?
I think it's deserved. I think there have been examples in which they have shown that the consequences would have been worse had they not mobilized as quickly, or had they not been able to simply tell people to leave their homes and have people obediently do so. You know, I used to live in Mexico, and it was difficult to get people to obey the instructions because they wanted to stay with their livestock. They wanted to stay with their properties.
With Irma, we are seeing the flooding and damage in parts of the Caribbean. I saw some video footage from St. Martin earlier today. I mean, people are talking about a historic hurricane. Is there a bit more anxiety than usual this time in Cuba?
The thing that worries most people is the idea of these storm surges coming, flooding into not just Havana, which is obviously a coastal city, but all along the northern coast of Cuba. In Havana itself, where I'm speaking to you from Old Havana, which is obviously famed for its crumbling charm, if you like.
Yeah.
Well, those crumbling homes have got people living in them, and often two and three, four, five families living under one roof. They're well constructed originally, but it's been decades since they've had any investment, since they have been able to find sufficient construction materials or building materials to repair roofs, to repair beams. Some of the parts of the eastern tip of the island really haven't recovered from Hurricane Matthew, which clipped the eastern edge of the island on way to Haiti around this time last year. So, you know, everybody is aware that this is, it has the real potential to cause some deadly, deadly effects, consequences.
The BBC's Will Grant there in Havana. Also potentially in Irma's path is Haiti.
Haiti is so much more vulnerable than a country like Cuba, which has such an organized disaster response as well as a robust public health system.
That's Jim Ansara. He's CEO of Build Health International, which is involved in infrastructure projects in Haiti and helped with hurricane relief on the island after Matthew last year.
The Haitian government, which is incredibly resource-constrained, just does not have, especially in the rural areas, any kind of presence to really help mobilize people, to get people to shelter, to clothe and house people after a disaster like this.
What did you see when you were there last year after Hurricane Matthew?
You have all the same vulnerabilities that you do in the rest of the Caribbean, in terms of the initial storm surge and death and destruction from that. But then you have the added complexity of a very, very weak public health system that can't cope with the aftermath of these disasters. You have a great food insecurity to begin with. And we saw with Hurricane Matthew that almost all the crops and livestock on the southern peninsula were destroyed. And there's still incredible food insecurity.
Explain the food security situation a little bit more, because this also plays into infrastructure as well as agriculture.
Most of the agriculture and most of the people in rural Haiti survive on subsistence farming. And they have one very small crop. And when you get catastrophic rains or flooding, that crop is usually destroyed. And that's what happened in the case of Hurricane Matthew last year. And from Hurricane Matthew, there was not a robust enough response from the international community in terms of numbers of organizations or funds. And we're very, very concerned that given what's happening in Houston and what could happen in South Florida, that a response to a catastrophe in Haiti could be even that much weaker given everyone's focus at home.
Well, as I said, I mean, you were there last year after Hurricane Matthew, and now we've got Hurricane Irma. What were the big lessons learned? What did you learn after Hurricane Matthew?
Well, we're based at a large hospital, St. Boniface Hospital in the south, and we started preparing the hospital 4 days before the hurricane. And the hospital was able to operate not only through the hurricane, but immediately after that. And we were able to clear the road and get survivors into the hospital. So with a minimal amount of preparedness, with really small amounts of funding, you know, you can accomplish a lot. The problem is that there just isn't that focus in Haiti.
How should a wealthy country help a country like Haiti that just keeps getting battered and battered by natural disasters? There was the earthquake, Sandy, Matthew, and now Irma.
I work in Haiti. I volunteer. I invest in Haiti because I believe that we have an obligation, both in the United States and in Europe, to Haiti. If you look at the history of Haiti, much of the wealth of this country and many of the European countries was a result of our neglect of Haiti and interference with Haiti. So I feel particularly that it's incumbent on wealthy nations to help. And, you know, Haiti is 600 miles from Miami Beach, but you could be in the poorest, most impoverished parts of Africa. And to have that kind of disparity that close to our shores, I think is just wrong.
Jim Ansara, the CEO of Build Health International. Thanks very much, Jim.
Thank you.
The murder of a prominent journalist has sparked protests in India and shaken the country. The journalist was Gauri Lankesh. She was an outspoken critic of Hindu nationalist politics in India. Some say that made her a target. Police say they don't know the motive for her murder. Just that Gauri Lankesh was gunned down on the doorstep of her home in the city of Bangalore. Anu Bhuya is a reporter for the Wire news site in India. I asked her what she thought made Gauri a target.
Marco, we will not know that immediately. In fact, we may not ever know that. That's because India isn't doing very well on the Global Press Freedom Index. And in fact, the annual report that came out by the Reporters Without Borders cited the fact that Indian reporters are constantly being intimidated. So we may not know what the motives were. However, I'd like to point out, you know, one thing that makes a difference. I'm, in fact, from Bangalore. I grew up in Bangalore, where Gauri spent her working career and where she was finally killed. I now work as a journalist in Delhi. And there is a distinct privilege that I enjoy. You know, nobody would ever come to my door, my editor's door, and do this simply because we're in the national capital. But what has happened to her is in the state of Karnataka, which is at the other end of this country. And Gauri also, in some ways, has experienced some privilege in her death because we're talking about it. And we're talking about it even globally. The number of journalists who die in the hinterlands, who are killed in tribal areas, in rural areas, simply because they're all doing the same job that you and I are doing. You know, they're asking questions every day and they're seeking out the truth. It's risky, and people like Gauri were willing to, you know, go that whole nine yards, but not everybody's willing to do it because it's simply not a comfortable position for, you know, people who are perhaps less than Gauri, less brave, less courageous than Gauri.
Considering how controversial Gauri was, especially among right-wing activists and supporters of the government, how are they responding to her death?
Well, you know, there are two ways to look at this. There is your social media, which is one metric of how this works, and then there is your real world. Now, social media has been particularly vile, really, and a large number of people, many of whom claim on their Twitter profiles that they are Hindus, Hindu nationalists, and they have been saying the vilest of things, you know, from taking slights at her personal life. You know, they're calling her things like, they're calling her a Naxal, they're calling her a Muslim, which in India today has unfortunately become a derogatory term. So the union minister has now finally posted on Twitter, and he said that social media is not supposed to be an arena where people do these things. And he said, rest in peace, Gauri Lankesh. But this is one of the, you know, we really never see this kind of condemnation coming for death threats that journalists, especially women journalists, receive routinely in India. You know, it does not always translate into the real world, but it still creates an atmosphere that is intimidating and that's stifling to a journalist, and especially a woman journalist.
Finally, what void does Gauri's death leave for Indian journalism right now?
What Gauri was doing was really remarkable and exceptional, because for young journalists like me, there were just a few people, and there still are really just a few people like Gauri who would stick it out, you know, to whom the fear of death threats, fears of, or threats of assault, none of these things mattered, because there was a bigger picture for these guys. You know, there was something else that mattered beyond their own lives or their own story or their own byline or their own exclusive or, you know, whatever it is. There was something that was more important. There was some public good that was at the heart of the work that people like Gauri were doing, to do the kind of work that Gauri was doing, because there is no other way. What other way is there? Can we possibly imagine another way?
Anu Bhuya with India's The Wire news site, speaking with us from Delhi about the late Gauri Lankesh, who was killed this week. Anu, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Michael.
A million Syrians on the move, and one of them who's made it to Turkey has captured their souls. Coming up, a Syrian refugee makes good in Turkey. You're with The World.
Support for The World comes from LegalZoom.com. Time is money when you run a business, so don't waste valuable time on issues LegalZoom can help with. LegalZoom's network of independent attorneys was built to provide business owners with the advice they need for the day-to-day grind of running a business. And you'll never get hit with billable hours, since LegalZoom's not a law firm. Spend your time growing your business and use LegalZoom for the legal stuff. For special savings, be sure to enter promo code WORLD in the referral box at checkout. That's promo code WORLD at LegalZoom.com.
I like words.
A podcast.
Crunchy, crackly words.
About language.
Trixie, Tucker, Gentile.
The world in words.
Oh, heavens, my gracious landsake words.
The world in words.
Get it on Apple Podcasts.
Or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. It is a majority Buddhist country where a Muslim ethnic minority is the focus of a possible humanitarian catastrophe. The country is Myanmar, also known as Burma. The minority, the Rohingya. They faced discrimination for a long time from the Burmese government, but now they're fleeing violence by crossing over into neighboring Bangladesh. There are now hundreds of thousands of Rohingyas in refugee camps there. A UN spokesperson says they are mostly women, children, and the elderly.
Many of them have walked for many days. They're barefoot. They have lost many things along the way. Some of them have been robbed along the way. Some of them didn't have much to begin with because they fled with just the clothes on their backs. Some of them say they haven't eaten in days, not since they fled their village. They're very weak and they seem very traumatized.
The World's Patrick Nguyen has been following the migration of the Rohingya into Bangladesh. Just give us a quick timeline first, Patrick, of this latest bunch of atrocities against the Rohingya population. When did it start in Myanmar and how are they fleeing the country?
Well, it's actually been going on for decades, but it's accelerated in recent years. The army is doing sort of this stop-start purge, where they will go in and torch villages. There's even been state-sanctioned rape campaigns, killings of villagers, and they're doing everything they can to get the Rohingya to flee into Bangladesh. And so now it's kick-started again, and we've got 100,000-plus people pouring into Bangladesh.
You're saying the army, the Burmese army, has been going into these villages and burning them?
Yep. This has been going on for quite some time, and now it's kickstarted again. There is a trigger to this, and it's that there's this really ragtag Rohingya armed group that has been attacking police. The government calls them terrorists. I will note that they have only attacked, for the most part, hard targets like police and soldiers so far, but they're not that fearsome. I don't think they have that many people. A lot of them are armed with machetes and clubs. So when they will attack the police, the response from the army will be overwhelming force against civilians, and they will tag villages as sympathetic to the rebels and just purge them.
And human rights groups are documenting really horrifying stories from some of these Rohingya refugees who are in flight. What have you heard?
Just the worst things you can imagine. This isn't just rumors that people are hearing on the other side of the border once they've fled. Human Rights Watch has gone in and used satellite photos to show whole areas of Rohingya homeland just torched and burned to cinder. The stories of people once they arrive on the other side in Bangladesh are really appalling. And we're talking about violence against women and children and often sexual violence as well.
You saw some of these camps up close last year, right?
It was actually earlier this year, and I've just been thinking so deeply about the mess that they're walking into. Imagine a field of mud with hardly any trees, and you show up, and that's where you're meant to sleep. You just have to build this shelter out of mud and plastic trash and whatever you can find. These camps are now jam-packed. The population of Rohingya in Bangladesh is now equal to like Belize or the Bahamas. It's 400,000, 500,000 people. And Bangladesh doesn't want to encourage them to come over, so they've left these camps in a really rough state. And now they don't know what to do. There's even talk of shipping them all off to an island.
So as all this is going on with Rohingya, the sidebar story is, where is Nobel Peace Prize winner Aung San Suu Kyi and her criticism of what's going on? She is Burmese, and she's been quiet up till now. Tell us a bit about the criticism.
Aung San Suu Kyi is often criticized for not speaking up over the Rohingya, but I think it's actually much more insidious. Her offices have spoken out about this, and they have basically backed the military position. Her offices have mocked women who've lodged rape allegations against the army. They've used the Trumpian phrase, fake news. It would be political suicide for her to come out and say, you know what, guys, we should really let the Rohingya stay here and give them all citizenship. So that is usually the cover that diplomats and other people give her and say, well, look, she can't come out and say all this stuff because the public will hate her. I would counter that she actually could be doing more. She could work harder to let international aid in. She's not completely tied to this position.
I know the UN is all focused on sanctions for North Korea, but what about the Rohingya and what are the next steps for the UN on this?
That's a great question. I mean, they're struggling really just to document the death toll. The very latest is that Myanmar says, well, any UN censure that comes our way, we know that our buddy China is going to block it. And I think that that's actually a pretty reasonable expectation. China has very strong interest in Myanmar regarding fuel, regarding access to the Indian Ocean, because China doesn't have any real estate fronting the Indian Ocean and it needs it. China needs Myanmar, and I'm sure that they would block it if the UN Security Council did try to censure Myanmar.
The World's Patrick Nguyen, thanks very much for explaining this all.
Thanks, Marco.
5 million people have fled Syria since the war began there 6 years ago. More than half of the Syrian refugees have ended up just across the border in Turkey. It can be a precarious existence, but my BBC colleague Mike Thompson came across one success story in the southern Turkish city of Gaziantep.
I've come to a big shoe factory in an industrial area on the outskirts of Gaziantep. It's spread over four floors and exports more than $3 million worth of shoes every year. It's run by Mohammed Ghanem, who fled here from Aleppo just 4 years ago.
In the first 2 years, we have faced difficulties in Syria because we have factories inside Aleppo. We came to Turkey, we established a small factory, like 25 workers, with the help of the Turkish government. So we expand our work from a small factory to now the international company and factories.
Were you running a similar factory in Aleppo before?
Yes, in Aleppo we have a factory, we provide the Turkish market when we were in Syria. But when we came to Turkey, it will be difficult to manufacture and sell inside the same country. So we start to search for other markets. We go to some Arab countries like Morocco and Algeria. We thank God that our business is good, but we can manufacture in Turkey and export our goods to other countries.
Now, you've said that you started initially with just a couple of dozen workers. How many do you have now?
We start out with 25 workers, and now we have in season about 1,000 workers.
How hard has it been building your business here in Turkey?
Normally, Syrian people face a problem here in Turkey for opening their own business. But luckily for us, we previously work with the Turkish people. When we are in Aleppo, we export to them some goods from our factories. So they be kind and they help us to establish our worker with the machines, legitimize our work. So that's why the Turkish people, our friend, and also we get lucky more than the other Syrian people here.
And what about the future? You're building a big business here. When peace comes to Syria, finally, what will you do then? Will you stay here or will you go back?
Yes, we will come back when it's suitable for us. And we will not leave here also. Maybe we can leave an office for advertisement our goods. But we have to go. It's our land, Syria, and we have to help the economy there, especially with the re-establishment of the country after the war is done.
Syrian shoe factory owner Mohammed Ghanem speaking with the BBC's Mike Thompson in Turkey.
Support for this podcast comes from Goldman Sachs. Some of the most important questions facing the world today intersect with the global capital markets. Climate change, autonomous driving, the future of China's economic growth. On Exchanges at Goldman Sachs, the firm's podcast, you'll hear discussions on topics with far-reaching implications like these, plus much more. Think of it as a place to get insights from some of the world's leading thinkers on markets, industries, and the global economy. That's Exchanges at Goldman Sachs. Available on iTunes, Stitcher, SoundCloud, and Google Play, and at gs.com/podcast.
What would the news sound like if media were diverse?
Things get racialized here. Muslim is this weird racial thing here, and I don't think our parents were prepared for that.
I'm Rupa Shenoy, host of the podcast Otherhood. Listen to what you're missing on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Marco Werman. She is the unmistakable voice of North Korea's propaganda machine. Her name is Ri Chun-hee.
You know, if Ri Chun-hee says it, you know it's really serious.
So what's her backstory and why is she known as the Pink Lady? Stick around and find out. Still ahead on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. President Trump is facing a lot of pushback over his decision to rescind DACA, the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program, especially in California, which has a large population of DACA recipients.
What you did is immoral. Your decision is cowardly. It's irresponsible. You picked on the youngest Americans, on the vulnerable.
That was the message one immigrant rights activist had for the president at a rally in downtown Los Angeles yesterday. For more on what's at stake in California, if Congress does not come up with a DACA replacement, we turn to Saul Gonzalez. He's with station KCRW in Santa Monica. So you've been talking with many so-called dreamers, Saul, since yesterday's announcement. What have you been hearing?
I've been hearing fury and anger and outrage and what other synonym you want to use, but also a kind of a quiet resilience that we are not going to go anywhere no matter what happens with this program. And that came out in one conversation yesterday with Melody. She was brought to this country from Guatemala when she was 9 years old, and this is what she told me.
I'm an organizer, so I really don't have time to stop. I really don't have time to grieve or feel sad or sorry for myself or the 800,000 people affected by this. Me personally, I'm going to keep fighting, get the word out, and let other people know that they do have rights and educate them to come out of the shadows. I already did my time in the shadows and I'm not going back.
So, Saul, how much is someone like Melody counting on Congress to get things right in the next 6 months?
A lot, Marco. I mean, they really are looking for real movement on this over the next 6 months. And they say they will become personally involved. They will advocate. They will lobby. And, you know, a lot of the dreamers are savvy and canny enough to know that they have a great story, right? Theirs is a kind of American success story. They're students. They're fighting for their piece of the American dream. And I think they know that that plays very well. And that's a message they're really going to hammer home again and again and again in the coming weeks and months.
I mean, a lot is at stake for the state of California. There's the California economy, which is huge, the higher education sector, which is all over the state. How much could both of these be affected if Congress does not come up with some replacement for the DACA program? Because most of these young adults, they're in school or they're working or they're doing both.
Yeah, and we really have to talk about numbers here, Marco. I mean, one out of every four people covered by this act is here in California.
Wow.
We're talking over 200,000 people in the state, over 100,000 people just in Los Angeles County alone. That is like twice the number that are in the next state, which is Texas. So it's just a huge quantity of people here. But you know what? I mean, the California state institutions, our elected officials, our state university system, they're all saying we stand with the dreamers. Like with so many things with the Trump administration, we are going to fight this administration tooth and claw when it comes to protecting these students, these dreamers. And they say that, you know, that is not going to change. You're welcome here in California. We don't expect you to go anywhere. And what we suggest you do is just keep on leading your normal lives. Yes, advocate to preserve this program. Advocate to lobby Congress. But don't think about dropping out of school. Don't think about dropping out of your workplace and going into hiding. Don't do that. We're on your side.
Saul, do we have a sense of just how bad California's economy would be hit if this rescinding of DACA does go through?
Well, if you talk to the experts, Marco, they say we would take a huge hit here. I mean, essentially, this population is so integrated into the state's economy that you just can't remove them from the equation. And what would suffer? Everything from the service economy, hotels, restaurants, things like that, to our high-tech economy in Silicon Valley and here in Los Angeles. They say all of it could be affected and not in a good way.
How far are officials in California willing to go to protect the dreamers? Because a lot of people are skeptical about what Congress is going to be able to achieve in the next 6 months.
Well, they're willing to go as far as our attorney general, who says he's contemplating suing the administration. On the local front, the mayor of Los Angeles, Eric Garcetti, spoke yesterday, and he said, you know, you have a home here in Los Angeles. We will provide you legal assistance. You heard the same thing from county officials as well. We will put programs in place. I think Los Angeles County has already set aside $3 million to provide, you know, legal counseling to people covered by this program. And they say, if anything, that's just going to expand in the coming months and expect those programs to grow.
Saul Gonzalez with station KCRW in Santa Monica. About 75% of all DACA recipients, some 600,000 young men and women, were born in Mexico. And the Mexican government says it plans to push Congress in Washington to come up with legislation to protect the Dreamers. But if that doesn't happen, Mexico says it's ready to welcome back former DACA recipients and offer them help. Reporter Emily Green in Mexico City has been following the response from Mexican authorities.
Well, right now they're offering kind and generous words, which is to say, we welcome you back with open arms and we will help provide opportunities for you, including what they're saying is a special job bank to help Dreamers find jobs back here in Mexico, to enroll in public benefit programs, and additionally offer them scholarships. The governor of Jalisco, which is where the University of Guadalajara is located, said that the university there would offer scholarships to Dreamers who return to Mexico. And that sounds like Dreamers who return either voluntarily or are deported.
And just briefly, what kind of government reaction was there yesterday when Jeff Sessions, the attorney general, made this announcement?
Well, across Latin America, there was condemnation. The foreign minister of El Salvador said he would meet with Congress to urge them to find a solution to help legalize these Dreamers. A top Honduran official also said that he would meet with Congress to try and get them to act within 6 months. And in Guatemala, the foreign ministry there said it was counting on humanitarian sensibilities of Congress to ensure that these Dreamers are not, in fact, deported.
Yeah, many DACA beneficiaries, once they heard the announcement, they protested. They went out in the streets. Were there protests in Mexico?
There were protests in Mexico, including an impromptu protest in front of the U.S. Embassy en masse. And I talked to some of the folks there, including a woman by the name of Maria Jimenez. She was deported from Colorado just 4 months ago, and she has four kids in the Denver area. The three youngest are U.S. citizens, but her oldest is a DACA recipient. She's 20 years old. She moved to the United States when she was 2 years old, and she essentially has no memory of Mexico. That's according to her mother, Maria.
Nosotros no somos delincuentes, solamente queremos un mejor futuro. Entonces tenía como muchos sentimientos, confusión, desesperación, enojo.
And Maria there says that she and other parents of DACA recipients, they aren't criminals. She says they only want a better future. And so right now they have a lot of feelings. They feel confused. They feel disappointed. And they also feel angry. And she said she had talked to Brenda yesterday, and that Brenda, that her voice was breaking, and that she's not only facing the fact that her mother was deported 4 months ago, but that she too might be deported. And I asked Maria what she said to Brenda, and this is what she said.
Pues sí, yo lo único que le digo es que resista, que no se dé por vencida, y que pues todavía faltan 6 meses para tratar de hacer algo.
So Maria said what she's telling her daughter Brenda is that she needs to resist, not to become defeated, and that there are still 6 months to try and do something.
What is your sense, Emily? Will Mexico and Mexicans keep the pressure on Washington?
I think they absolutely will. Logistically, it's somewhat of a nightmare for them to receive some 600,000 kids back into their countries, many of them who don't speak Spanish, who don't have any memory of these countries. I think that they see this as a humanitarian issue, and also logistically, despite all the words of acceptance and encouragement and we'll welcome you back with open arms, I think that this is a real challenge for them.
Emily Green in Mexico City, thanks very much for your reporting. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Remember that threat of nuclear war with North Korea? Let me take you back to, just a few days ago. Here's the official North Korean television announcement of Pyongyang's latest nuclear bomb test on Sunday, and pay no attention to the production values.
Soviet
Still discovering the crossfade in North Korea, it is tough to find a light side to potential nuclear war. But if there is a light side, it's the woman behind that voice. It's the same woman who's fronted North Korean TV for something like 40 years now. Her name is Ri Chun-hee, and Derek Hawkins of The Washington Post just wrote a profile of this remarkable woman. Derek, tell us who she is.
So Ri Chun-hee is the most famous news anchor for Korean Central Television. This is the state-run media in North Korea. She's been around for a long time. She's in her mid-70s now, and she is the news anchor that the North Korean regime trots out to make big announcements, things like missile tests, nuclear tests, national festivities, that sort of thing. And she's probably best known for this deep, theatrical, melodramatic voice that she has, you know, this kind of booming and sometimes even vitriolic voice with which she delivers the regime's news.
Right, as we just heard. So she's not the nightly news presenter. She gets all the kind of big stories, the sensational things.
Yeah, you know, if Ri Chun-hee says it, you know it's really serious. You know, she was on for a long time a nightly anchor, but about 5-6 years ago, she went into retirement, and now she comes back out for these big sort of earth-shattering announcements.
And it's not just that stentorian presentation. She has a particular look, too, right? Can you describe it?
Sure. She's very fond of these pink robes, these pink traditional two-piece robes, and they've earned her the title of Pink Lady. This is something that all the news anchors on Korean Central Television, or all the female news anchors on Korean Central Television, tend to wear. But she loves this vibrant pink color, so that's earned her this Pink Lady title.
Right. So the Pink Lady, Ri Chun-hee. Where is she from, and how'd she get into broadcasting? Do you know?
Well, it's, you know, the details of her life are kind of murky, but most reports say she was born in the early 1940s, probably 1943. She was supposedly from a poor rural family in what is now the southeastern part of the country. And she went to theater school in Pyongyang. She was studying to be an actor, apparently. And at some point, it's not exactly clear how she transitioned into media. And she ended up moving up the ladder pretty quickly. She was around for Korean Central Television's sort of early stages. And in 1971 is when she started there. And then by 1974, she had become a nightly news anchor. And then by the 80s, she was sort of this constant presence. And she'd really developed this authoritative tone. And that's when she sort of came into her own.
Yeah, I mean, that authoritative tone really stands out. It's kind of this stabbing kind of impact in her voice. Was that there from the beginning when she was a news presenter, or is it kind of she's worked it up over the years?
There was a North Korean magazine profile of her in 2009 that described how she was mentored by Kim Il-sung, the former leader. Kim Il-sung was responsible for the development of her voice. Now, of course, you know, people attribute all kinds of crazy stuff to Kim Il-sung. There was even a rumor for a long time that people believed that he could fly. So yeah. It's not totally clear, but it seems like it's something that she's cultivated over the years. You know, one famous clip of her came in 1994, and that's when she announced the death of Kim Il-sung. And, you know, you can see her in that video. She's crying. Her delivery is very heavy and somber. And then 17 years later, of course, she delivered the news that Kim Jong-il had died.
Well, I'm glad you set that up, because we actually have Ri Chun-hee's announcement of Kim Jong-il's death in 2011. We can really appreciate her full vocal depth and range here. Let's have a listen. Derek Hawkins, I suspect that somebody like Ri Chun-hee doesn't have any choice but to cry when they make an announcement of one of the leaders of North Korea. Do you know what the voice of the DPRK in a pink robe makes annually?
Oh, man, I could not tell you. I couldn't tell you, but, you know, they're again, reports out of the country say that she lives in relative luxury in Pyongyang with her grandchildren and children. And that certainly seems plausible, you know, given what a long and successful career she's had. Although, who's to say?
Derek Hawkins of The Washington Post telling us about the remarkable face and voice of North Korean television, the Pink Lady Ri Chun-hee. Derek, thank you very much.
Thanks very much.
주최 배고 2016년 1월 6일 10시
It's another week and another Atlantic storm that weather watchers are calling unprecedented. Puerto Rico is dealing with Hurricane Irma's powerful impact right now. And earlier in the show, we heard from people in Haiti and Cuba hunkering down for Irma's arrival there. We'll keep following the storm closely as it heads toward Florida in the days ahead. And of course, we're still watching how residents of Texas and Louisiana are doing after Harvey flooded them just last week. Now, I know there's a lot of plain old chance involved here, but I also know I'm not alone in wondering if there isn't something very new and different going on with these big back-to-back storms. So I've got the world's environment editor, Peter Thompson, here to help us sort some of this out. So first of all, Peter, how rare is a string of major storms like this? And I've got to ask, what, if anything, does climate change have to do with these two incredible storms coming back-to-back?
Well, climate change does have something to do with it, but it's complicated, and a lot of it does come down to the randomness of nature. You know, big storms like this brew up in the tropical oceans, the Atlantic and the Pacific, every year. They always have, including some very big ones that just never make landfall, and so we don't even pay attention to them. Mm. There's a lot of randomness involved in how these two storms came up and the fact that they're heading to the southeastern United States almost back-to-back. And, you know, and remember also that with these two storms, we're talking about two very different measures of their intensity. Last week with Harvey, it was rain, an unfathomable amount of rain. With Irma, at least for now, we're talking about wind. You know, some of the highest and most dangerous wind speeds ever recorded for a storm in this part of the world. But again, different storms, potentially different kinds of impacts.
We do know, though, that climate change is contributing to more severe weather. And right behind Irma is Jose and another one right behind Jose. So what's going on?
Yeah. And I mean, this was definitely the clear message from climate scientists last week with Harvey. In general, a warming atmosphere and warming oceans means more energy being transmitted between them. And that energy is what feeds storms like these. It also puts more water into the air. And that, of course, can mean a lot more rain. And Harvey, you know, was definitely made worse by a lot of very warm water in the Gulf of Mexico that basically pumped a lot more water into the storm that came down
right
as rain. You know, and then there are also higher storm surges that we get with the higher sea levels we're seeing with climate change. So higher water gets pushed farther inland by a storm's winds. So, you know, when a lot of people ask me, was an extreme weather event like this caused by climate change? It's actually the wrong question. It's not about cause. It's about influence. You know, extreme weather has always happened, always will. Climate change doesn't cause a hurricane or a blizzard or a drought, but it likely does make it worse. Years ago, somebody explained the difference to me between weather and climate like this. Climate is what you expect. Weather is what you get.
Mm.
What we're expecting these days is changing, so what we're getting is starting to change too. And I guess, you know, from where I sit, the key thing right now is really to stop arguing over whether climate change caused something or even how much it affected it, as it is to get on to preparing ourselves better for what we know is coming.
Right. Well, I mean, I was just looking at video footage from St. Martin, which got hit by Irma, 185 mile an hour winds. I mean, the downtown area looks like it got hit by a bomb. When do people start to change, like, where they live?
Yeah, well, I mean, the answer to that is just about as massively complicated as the question of how storms form and why and where and when. You know, why people live someplace and stay living someplace when it's in harm's way. It's about economics. It's about politics. It's about culture. You know, I mean, clearly,
it's about heart, where you want to be.
Absolutely. You know, just warning people isn't enough. Some people have no choice but to live where they do. Others are locked in by something like, you know, a house they can't sell. Others, like you said, genuinely love where they live and they don't want to leave no matter what. You know, and then there's the role of government and business, both of which often either haven't taken the risks of climate change seriously enough or they don't have the resources to respond in the ways that they should. So, you know, what a lot of experts are saying is that what we really need now are full throttle efforts to evaluate the risks, give people and businesses information, and then give them incentives and assistance to move in the most vulnerable places, but also to redesign those places whenever you can to protect them better and make them better able to survive something like this.
The World's Environment editor, Peter Thompson, thanks for talking this through.
Thanks, Marco.
Here's another story about climate change and the real effects that changing weather patterns are having on farmers. In this case, coffee farmers in Ethiopia, home of the legendary Yirga Chefe coffee bean. Here's my BBC colleague Emmanuel Igunza reporting from the eastern part of Ethiopia.
It hasn't rained here for months. Yet another year of failed rains looms. Coffee trees are drying up. Some have withered and died. In one corner, a group of women are using big plastic and metal buckets to get water from a big tank to irrigate the plants. The water is drawn from a river several kilometers away as all other water sources have dried up. And it's not just here that they are feeling the effects of changing climate. A new report says up to 60% of all land currently under coffee farming in Ethiopia could be wiped out within the next 100 years due to the effects of climate change. The government has been trying to encourage farmers to move their coffee plants to higher ground where lower temperatures can protect them. Bekir Abdullahi is an agricultural officer here in Harar.
The government is encouraging every farmer should have at least 1 means of irrigation water so that he can just supplement as a supplementary irrigation to farm whenever the rainfall is so short in fall like this year. And in fact, the challenge of climate is clear, and no one can cope with it. We are trying. Farmers are just trying to conserve the moisture. And as you see, just the climate changes soon or later, it is affecting us, and it also depends upon our endeavor to cope with it. If we are sitting and sleeping, the climate is just undoubtedly it is going to kill us.
Coffee is believed to have been first grown and brewed here in Ethiopia. Last year alone, it earned the country more than $900 million in foreign exchange. At least 15 million farmers engage in its farming. But it's not just an economic benefit, as it plays a cultural role too here in Ethiopia.
I can't stand a day without drinking a coffee because I do love so much, and then I drink often. I drink at home. And I do with my friends like this most of the time. This is the sad news, actually, the climate change. Oh, that's not good.
I love coffee a lot. I drink maybe 3 or 4 times a day. I've been drinking coffee since I was a small boy. I prefer homemade coffee, though. The traditional way is much, much better. I love coffee. It's a part of me. I don't think I'm addicted, but I just love coffee.
Coffee, often described as Ethiopia's greatest gift to the world, could face its biggest challenge yet.
We are grateful for the gift, Ethiopia, and thanks to the BBC's Emmanuel Igunza for that story. That'll do it for us today. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH here in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. We'll see you back here tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.